So we're going to have an opportunity for you all to ask some questions to participate. We're going to have an opportunity for our panelists to ask whatever questions they may have of each other during this process. But perhaps if I could just start it off, we've heard some things said during the course of the various presentations about the whole concept of holographic universe. I think to some degree, many of us have some understanding of that, but could you all flesh that out for us so we can all be on the same page?
Well, let me not touch on holographic consciousness because I don't like the model. It's my prejudice. Let me comment on Evan's talk, though. Since I have the floor, might as well do it. Of course, it was a great talk. That you don't need me to say. But the wonderful idea that he conveyed towards the end, I want to emphasize that. Why is this taking us to the forefront of consciousness research? This kind of experiences that he brought back, although nobody would wish somebody to suffer from what you did. But the wonderful gift is tremendous. It's a pioneering kind of work because if you are sensitive, this is the point, if you look at from this quantum physics point of view, then what is taking place? We have an experiment called delayed choice experiment, and it's can be verified by laboratory students, graduate students, so don't doubt it. It says that if there is a series of possibilities taking place one after the other, these possibilities will all collapse at the moment you are able to collapse them. In other words, when the observer is available, namely when he woke up from his near death, at that moment, all of the series of experiences that came to him, that was collapsed. So what does that mean? If that state is a much more free state, because it's free of the brain, then of course nothing could happen in any kind of model of physics. So brain is still very important. Brain possibilities are still very important, and the brain gives us the Rorschach out of which one constructs the mental images of whatever one is getting. But it is that whatever one is getting, that's the part which is seriously important and we have to think about it. What do we get that we don't usually get in the conscious awareness? What is the biggest barrier? Conscious awareness, because of that tangled hierarchical collapse I said yesterday, comes always with mental thought. And thought is limited. It is limited. It does have access to intuition, but you have to be sensitive to the intuition. And that sensitivity is blocked in the normal awareness. Most people don't even have it. People who are creative, they have it. People who are sensitive, spiritual, they have it. People who are in love, they have it. But normally, people just don't have it. So this doors of perception, you know, that's a title of a book by, wonderful book by Aldous Huxley. A new door of perception has opened up to us. I wish we could do controlled experiments. You can tell more about this if it's ever possible. Dean can tell more about this too. But it would be wonderful because this doors of intuition that we are seeing that is opening up and sensitivity is enormously enhanced. It's much more potential than I think LSD research ever could. This is just a wonderful entry point because the intuition obviously is bringing images to the mind to construct that is just not normally available in our waking awareness. Even I suspect that even deep meditation cannot easily lead to this kind of door of perception. So this is one aspect that I think everybody should remember. And now the experimentalists can tell me if this is feasible ever to do controlled laboratory experiments on near death.
Any comments from you, Eben?
Well, I would say that this is really part of the new awakening and understanding in terms of consciousness, and that getting deeper into the mystery of quantum mechanics is realizing that the brain does play that role more as the limiter, that that permits only certain manifestations down in this reality. And yet consciousness itself is on the other side of that veiling function, and can be much more in contact with a far broader category of possibilities, kind of the quantum possibilities. And that's really, I think, the big question here in our current scientific investigations of that intersection of consciousness and mind and brain, is trying to understand more about how that functions, and how is it that the brain works more as that limiting system, and how can we manipulate that to allow for the full range of possibilities to be manifest, which is really what happens as consciousness is manifested on this side of the veil. Quickly,
let me interject one question. This you should be able to answer very well. How about anesthesia? Would that lead to enough coma to get into near death? Is there any evidence at all that under anesthesia people get into any such thing?
Well, there are some wonderful cases in the near-death literature where people under very deep anesthesia, and this is especially in the neurosurgical world, where we're also doing a full circulatory arrest and other things to really kind of shut down the physical workings of the brain, where in fact people can end up having profound experiences, including veridical information that is passed to them that they really would have no other way of knowing. And those occur in that setting of general anesthesia. By and large, those kinds of episodes in anesthesia are considered mistakes of anesthesia, especially if people perceive pain or something when they're supposed to be perceiving nothing. And of course, another part of general anesthesia that's usually the case is it seems to obliterate any sense of passage of time, at least while someone is under that general anesthesia. And I must say, one thing that I started encountering in deep meditative states is that complete disconnect of time flow. Whereas, in fact, and it's very reminiscent of the situation in life reviews that people experience. So you can have people who have a very, very brief NDE where they're only kind of gone from this world for seconds, and yet they can go through a very full-blown life review of incredible detail of each and every one of the events of their life that are to be reviewed. So time flow in that realm is completely different. And that was something that was shown to me very clearly in my journey. It was actually very graphically demonstrated how time flow in this realm is very much an illusion. And there's what I call deep time that is part of that spiritual realm that is really the flow of a much higher causality. And but these are all kind of independent of that world of general anesthesia. By and large, general anesthesia is there because it seems to temporarily stop the flow of consciousness for a certain period of time for an individual. And for those who've been under general anesthesia, they know what I'm talking about. It basically, you can be under for hours, but it seems like you're only gone for a second. But I don't think that general anesthesia, as kind of a general principle, is a way to get at these deep conscious states. I think meditation, and again, as I mentioned briefly last night, the work with Sacred Acoustics was really in an attempt to pursue a similar state to what I'd gone through with my meningitis, where the meningitis had destroyed my neocortex. So what I was looking for was a way to temporarily achieve something similar. And the way it works with these sound meditations, as we do in the Sacred Acoustics work, is with those differential sound frequencies that interact with a very primitive part of the brainstem that modern neuroscience says is part of the whole mechanism of consciousness. When you think about it, one of the challenges for the physical brain over evolution was that you had to end up kind of subbing out various sub-functions to different modules within the neocortex, and somehow that needs to be bound together. It's called the binding problem in consciousness. It gives us this kind of oneness of consciousness, and part of that is having an eternal now signal that's coming up, and that now signal is supposedly generated in the reticular activating formation down in the lower brainstem that just so happens to be next to the timing circuit that is the circuit that we influence with these differential sounds hitting the two ears. And the effect of that, to make a long, long, long story short, is to take that timing system and synchronize the electrical activity in the brain, basically taking the information processing function of the neocortex offline. Now, I say that as if I know it. I don't know it at all. It's kind of the theory that we're working with. And to me, it explains somewhat the effects that we see. I mean, for example, the binaural beats were shown way back in the 70s and 80s to offer potential enhancements, say, for remote viewing skills and the remote viewers of the, you know, of the intelligence community. And they realized that it had great power, but didn't understand exactly how it worked. The general idea, of course, though, is by taking that neocortex and basically monotonizing it with this synchrony of electrical signals, that then allows conscious awareness to be set free. And I believe that's what's happening, but it is by no means proven in any sense.
Dean Radden, have you been able to follow any of this?
General anesthesia.
Have you been able to hear the conversation thus far?
What I was going to say, it probably has been covered to some extent already, but what we know from the experimental work on various kinds of psychic phenomena is that what we see in the laboratory is not coming as a result of magic fairy dust that suddenly appears. Rather, it suggests that we have some degree of psychic awareness all the time. And so the question is reversed almost from a laboratory perspective. Why are we not completely psychic always, as compared to why are there only spontaneous small effects in most people most of the time? And Eben had already mentioned that in a sense the frontal lobes get in the way. Our brain gets in the way of us being able to perceive what is actually there, but we're not able to grasp it because that's not the way that our brain works. So one of the ideas that we're looking at is how to momentarily turn off the frontal lobes in a reasonably safe way. And the method that we have on paper at this point is to use transcranial DC stimulation. And what that means is you put two electrodes roughly across the frontal lobes about here. You send a 1 milliamp current, continual DC current across the frontal lobes, and it inhibits that portion of the brain. Now, the total amount of current is very, very low, and you only do it for 30 seconds at a time. But when you do that, then the features of the frontal lobes are reduced. The activity of the frontal lobes are inhibited. And so we know that from many other studies, and we thought, well, if it is true that the frontal lobes get in the way, then we should be able to do an experiment on telepathy or clairvoyance or whatever you wish and actually improve performance while that stimulation is occurring. And so this is medically reasonably safe. There have been thousands of experiments done. It doesn't produce brain lesions or anything like that. And at this point, we're still working with our institutional review board to make sure that it is in fact safe. And that when people give informed consent for this sort of experiment, that they understand the risks. And if we can get past all of that, we have a medical doctor who will be present when we do these experiments. We'll actually see whether it's possible to modulate which portions of the brain are active and see if indeed psychic ability is improved. I suspect that it will be because there's a lot of additional evidence saying that various portions of the brain essentially get in the way. And so we just as I heard it just a little bit about the use of meditation for doing this, and meditation as well modulates what portions of the brain are active. So this may be a technological way of achieving what is done through maybe 30 years of meditation, and we'll find out.
The very important clue that you can give is this is fantastic for these experiments because the frontal lobe, the suspension of the neocortex has a proof because the time sense will disappear. Time happens with the collapse of the quantum possibilities. That's how time comes about, this future going time. So if time is suspended, general anesthesia can do this, near death can do this. If this kind of DC current or meditative technique with hearing sound can do this, this is just fantastic new tool for experimenting with consciousness.
I think one other brief point to make along these lines, there's a beautiful paper from the Imperial College in London that's actually referenced in Proof of Heaven by Carhart Harris, and it was a study done in using functional MRI scan that basically looks at blood flow and uses that as a proxy for neuronal activity. And they were investigating patients who were voluntarily taking psilocybin and having transcendental conscious states and that were basically engendered by their use of this of psilocybin, a psychedelic drug. And the hypothesis was that those with the most profound, robust explorations deep in consciousness, the most powerful drug experiences, would have increased excitability in the cortex, as shown by functional MRI. What they actually found was just the opposite, that those junctional regions of the neocortex in the people who had the most profound experiences were actually much quieter, were shut down compared to baseline. And again, that's perfectly consistent with the kind of experience I had where there was this great enhancement of reality by taking parts of the neocortex, in my case, basically taking the whole neocortex and shutting the thing down. And I think we're just beginning to understand how the brain physically can work as a veiling mechanism. And I would say that the veil that we often go through, say in near-death experiences or other spiritually transformative experiences or through deep meditation or centering prayer, that veil probably has a lot of its anatomic substrate is right there in the neocortex itself.
We did an experiment we published recently on looking at the brain function of mediums as they were doing mediumship. And one of the aspects of it was that a medium would read a client, of course, was blind to who the client was, and also only knew the first name of the individual, the deceased individual that the client was interested in. So the medium would contact that individual, read them, and then ask a series of questions. There were planned questions, 20 questions. And we're able to look at their brain function as they were asking the questions and getting answers. And what we found in that is that the central parietal area, which is roughly behind there, actually was showed less activity when the medium was more accurate. So again, there's another indicator that the brain can get in the way with a possible confound. The confound is that if you're measuring somebody's EEG and you simply ask them to pay attention to something, then you see a reduction in electrical activity in the cortex, everywhere in the cortex. It's called desynchronization. And so this is a very well-known aspect of a brain function. It looks like the brain is powered down, but that's actually not the case. It's simply that all the brain waves desynchronize and they cancel each other out. So well, at this point, it looks as though a reduction in brain activity is associated with better performance, but it might also be that there's a different form of concentration that is happening, which causes a desynchronization of that portion of the brain. And we don't know yet which one of those two is the likely answer. And it's even true for using a functional MRI that when you see either an increase or decrease in blood flow, it may be due to actual reduction or an inhibition of that portion of the brain, but maybe not. It may be due to a desynchronization of what's happening in the brain.
During the course of everything that has been said, we've heard the word illusion, appearance, fabrication pop up in different contexts related to the brain. Maybe from your different perspectives, could you say a little bit about those ideas? and what's going on?
Well, you know, my view of the illusory description is that what happens in the conscious experience with thought is really a little bit, certainly a little bit confusing because thought is limited. But on the other hand, it's not illusion in the sense that there is regularity. Anything that has scientific regularity that can be reproduced is not illusion in the sense that illusion, once removed, never would confuse you. But that is just not the case. You can remove the illusion through knowledge, through whatever, yogic or whatever. Any mystic can claim that. But when the mystic is conscious in the normal way, still the illusion comes back. It's compulsory. So we should never lose sight of that. So this this way of saying that certain illusions are created before us is a little misleading, because we know that a true illusion, like a mirage, goes away. And but this illusion always comes back, always returns. It's compulsory. So this tangled hierarchical mechanism in the brain is producing an experience which is real. It's not that it's the all of reality. That part of Ibn Stark was just fine, but it's certainly a portion of reality. The trick for us, the challenge for us, is to how to overcome the limitations of thought. And this is the whole mystical spiritual approach, and now we are finding different approaches too, is to enhance our doors of perception. But we must not completely negate it. I think words like illusion negates it a little bit too much, to my taste.
Well, I would say hallucination and illusion are relative. And again, a lot of my journey has been stepping back far enough to try and glimpse truth from being far enough away to see the patterns and to see the reality underlying it. What we're all experiencing right now is very much a class of hallucination or a class of illusion. It's just different. It's one that seems to have a certain fidelity to what we have as an understanding of underlying reality. And yet it's very important to understand that, I mean, this whole that idea of doors of perception, that to me was a very kind of mind-opening book. I know I went to a conference a few years ago that was sponsored by a bioethics group in Madison, Wisconsin, and it was basically, the main topic was on death and dying. The first day was on near-death experiences, which to me made some degree of sense. The second day was all on psychedelic drugs. And I had never really given it enough thought, but come to realize that we're talking about various ways of peering into the nature of reality. I think that, you know, near-death experiences are a pretty obvious example, but also the use of psychedelic drugs can often give some great insight into the nature of underlying reality and certainly the nature of consciousness. And to simply say, well, that's all hallucinatory, and therefore we can dismiss it, is somewhat misleading. One has to back off enough to realize that, as I said earlier, this our modern neuroscientific view of what each and every one of us would call reality is really just that electrochemical flickering, the firing pattern of 100 billion neurons in a 3-pound gelatinous mass in a warm, dark bath. And yet we kind of think, well, it's all that reality out there. Well, you know, we really have to step back far enough to try and be objective to see, you know, how can we get closer to the truth about that underlying reality? And I think Dean is the way towards that truth. So I'll let you answer, Dean.
What came to mind for me is that within a large branch of academic psychology, of course, is all about the study of what we think we perceive. That visual illusions are a very easy way to demonstrate that everything that we perceive is a construction. And it's easy to show that by just showing an illusion, a visual or auditory or other forms of sensory illusions, that demonstrate very well that our brain is tricking us all the time. In fact, one of the most common comments that you hear if somebody has a traffic accident is that they did not see the other car. And they're not lying. They really didn't see it because their brain at the moment was engaged in doing something else, and they didn't present it to them. So you have both our visual perception and all of our other senses that are constantly creating what looks like a stable reality. But you also have language, which puts an additional constraint on what we're perceiving. So we're talking and trying to convey ideas now, but they're extremely simplified. And you see this immediately when somebody has a mystical experience and then comes back and tries to describe it. I'm sure Ibn has had this very problem, that the experience before it reaches language is much, much richer than it could possibly be expressed. And so you express it in an artistic way or in a poetic way, and that only scratches the surface. So we do the best we can with language and recognize that that also is kind of an illusion. Although I think I agree with Ahmed, it's not illusory in the sense it's not real. It's more like an illusion, like a cartoon is kind of an illusion.
Good.
Okay, the cartoon gets the up. We're going to open it up for questions from the floor. I had one previously, and then we'll take it around, because obviously we're not going to have time for all of you, so think them through well.
The question I had was, how might you relate the experiences people have when they are a part and take part and hear a wonderful creative symphony, like, you know, name the great composers? Can that perhaps be a doorway into the levels in which we would like to reach, because it calms down the everyday analytical take apart mind and gets us into the more broader realms of experience? We have two ears.
Anyone?
Well, you know, in India, they really believe, and I have this Surat Sabda Yoga that even mentions this sound techniques. Their validity entirely depends on, I think, shutting off the neocortex partially. So it could very well be, and Dean can tell us if experiments can be done to demonstrate this, it could very well be that sound has that special effect. People even say that Om chanting, if you chant the Om, that Sanskrit word, correctly, the way that yogis teach us, that's not the usual, we don't know anymore how to chant it properly. But if you did, then you could reach states, ineffable states, which you later collapse and form thought forms, and that would be much more telling about the nature of reality than our ordinary perceptions suggest. So you may very well have a point there to investigate.
I think sound, you know, as I mentioned last night especially, has been used for thousands of years to engender very deep transcendental conscious states. Amazes me in kind of going through a lot of the literature on these mystical experiences, how they can often be precipitated out of the most commonplace little nothing little set of events, and people can be changed forever. So it's not just through, you know, beautiful sunsets, falling in love, incredible symphonies, that kind of thing. But sometimes it comes completely unbidden, and those are some pretty astonishing stories. The more you hear about them. And I think, in my view, it has a lot more to do with kind of a soul's journey and where a soul is in that journey. And sometimes that whole higher soul just taps in and changes everything.
According to the Yoga Sutras, written by Patanjali about 2,000 years ago, to achieve enlightenment, there are a number of methods, one of which is being born in the correct way, which you don't have much say over, at least not in this form. Another is that some people are simply talented. Some have talents to be able to go in and out of different states, and there too, we don't have that much control of it. Another is meditation. And of course, that's a yogic path. Spend 30 years in a cave and you will achieve that. But if you don't have the time or the inclination, another method is psychedelic drugs. So if you want to take any average person and get maybe 90% of them to have a profound mystical experience, you take psilocybin. And so the studies, for example, at Johns Hopkins, have shown that for average people have never taken any kind of psychedelic before. Many of them, the majority, will have an experience that they will then say 20 years afterwards was the single most profound experience of their entire lives. So in the yogic path, the use of drugs is not recommended because it's an artificial way of forcing you into the state where you won't stay. Whereas if you achieve it through meditation, you have the option of consciously deciding to go there or not. But if, given our lives today where we don't have such luxuries, I would say then that at some point we would hope that drugs like psilocybin become available to people who are seriously interested in inner exploration, and that then provides a way for anyone under the right circumstances to experience at least a glimpse of what that state is like without spending 30 years in a cave.
I would just put a vote out there for the meditation. I mean, I think that psychedelic drugs are a wonderful way to get deeply into a study of consciousness. And in the proper sacred setting with a very professional like shamanic guidance, yes, they can be useful. I know certainly from my own experience with the work in the sacred acoustics and that kind of sound enhancement of deep meditation, I was not long ago exposed to that beautiful book, Dark Night, Early Dawn by Christopher Bache about transpersonal psychology, where he really compared a lot of that and made some very good points about the power of psychedelics to give us incredible insight. But he also was very much honoring the work of Robert Monroe, and that's the same kind of work that's now been extended in the work of Karen Newell and Kevin Cossey in Sacred Acoustics. From my point of view, the psychedelics also create quite a splash, and it's kind of like trying to look at the reflection of a beautiful forest in a lovely pond in the woods, and when you throw that big rock in there, you get a gigantic splash, and it's kind of harder to bring some of the lessons back from that realm because of that splash of the psychedelic drugs. And even though it may take longer to get there through meditation, and especially sound-induced meditation, which is very powerful, I think it's well worth putting in that effort and taking that time to do it, because I think the lessons can be a lot more pure.
I also have a criticism of psychedelic drugs, because it seems like there is much more activity in the neocortex with psychedelic drug. It's just a different kind of activity, agreed. It's a different door of perception, but the neocortex remains intact. Thoughts don't stop by any means. It's just different. So from that point of view, we are talking about thoughts being the basic impairment of the intuitive stuff that come to us directly. We don't have that apparatus yet directly to perceive intuitions. We perceive intuitions through thought. We perceive feelings also mainly through thought, although a little bit, some people have the privilege of experiencing feelings in their body. We all have potentially, but we don't use it. So thoughts are the limiting factor, as meditators all over the world discovered long time ago. Krishnamurti, if you remember, constantly talk about get rid of thought. So in this way, I think that there is a good distinction between meditation and these techniques like psychedelic, because psychedelic makes the brain also very active. It's very do-do-do brain. And in that kind of brain, I don't know how much reliance we can put on any kind of construction that we put later on from the experiences.
Right. I agree with what you're saying, that from the point of view of having control and a safe and gentle manner, hardly anything beats meditation, which is why, we know it has a lot of other mental and physical benefits. But the question here is about what can I do? And I usually do say, when people ask, well, how do I become more intuitive or psychic? And the answer is meditation. That's the traditional method. It works. But we live in a society where we want fast food and fast enlightenment and fast everything. And so can we accelerate the meditative process? Maybe some. Sound can do that, and binaural beats and those kinds of things will help a little bit. But what if somebody is terminally ill and they don't have the time anymore? And so there are some circumstances and also some personalities. I find it very difficult to simply sit down and spend the amount of time and discipline that it takes in order to achieve these other states. So the studies I think that are most valuable with psychedelics are with the terminally ill, because for them, they don't have the luxury of the time. They need to simply have an impact that may not be gentle, and it may be a gigantic multicolored splash, but nevertheless, it tells them first person that your body and you are not exactly the same thing. There's something else. In that circumstance, then something like a psychedelic makes a lot of sense to me. For younger people, probably not, because it can destabilize who you think you are, and you need to be a grounded person as well. So there are many techniques. They match personalities in different ways, and they match different stages of life in different ways. And that's why I usually like to give the whole smorgasbord, and then each person has to decide for themselves.
All right, Richard over here.
This is mostly for Eben. I had an odd experience last night. I found your talk very inspiring and compelling. Then I went home and I watched a TV documentary about Afghanistan. And these people were pretty wretched. You had women carding wool for $1 a week. This was an odd contrast to "you will be taken care of." How would you respond to that?
Well, I think the important thing to realize is I see that all of this is really about our spiritual growth, and that to achieve, happiness, a state of bliss, well-being within, one's life is very largely dependent on our spiritual side, and not so much on what can be accumulated in the material. In fact, I would say the only value of any kind of wealth in the, accomplishments and in the material realm has to do with how our spiritual side dispenses that to manifest that love and forgiveness and compassion and sharing and taking care of fellow beings. And there are many hardships and difficulties in this world. There's a lot of lack and a lot of maldistribution. And yet, all of that, I think, is something that gets better as we come to realize the eternal spiritual beings that we are, and that this is really about that love and compassion and showing that unconditional love and being able to manifest that. No question, there's plenty of hardship, warfare, suffering, inhumanity, man's inhumanity to man. There's plenty of that out there, but that is what I think is part of this global conscious awakening that I believe is coming to this world, which is much more rectification and an alignment of the teachings of religious mystics and prophets going back for millennia. And it does involve, as far as our existence in the material realm, simply acknowledging that as the fundamental coin of the realm, that love, that's who we truly are. And this world will become a much better place the more we come to realize that and share that and make sure that all of us are knowing that each and every one of us is responsible really for that oneness and for that love. And our ascendance really has to do with that kind of realization. And the more we can live that and manifest it, the better this world will be.
I do have a comment on this also. The thing that we should recognize that what is happening in the Middle East or places like Afghanistan is a very tragic example of why we need a worldview change, and pronto, as quickly as possible. Right now, there really is a battle going on. Even in America, the battle is obvious. Why are the Republicans and Democrats are so opposed to each other? Because the Republicans see that there is a worldview split, and they can take advantage of it. Democrats started it by siding with the scientific materialists. This worldview split is much more, although not explicit, but much more implicit in places like Afghanistan or Middle East. because there the Muslim fundamentalists really see a threat to their entire lifestyle, entire culture, which has existed since the 7th century until now and given them a relatively stable society. All of a sudden, scientific materialism is coming along and revolutionizing them. Not, of course, to undermine the progress we made under modernism that happened in the last three centuries, but not in the 20th. 20th is the century of scientific materialism. It really produced a huge destruction of very stable religious cultures in Tibet, in India, in places like China, in, of course, Middle East and Afghanistan, which are under Islam. And we have to really appreciate that threat that scientific materialism brings to these very religious, stable cultures. And that's the fight is about. The reason that people can get jihadis, the people who are ready to commit suicide for the sake of their religion and culture, is because they feel this very strongly, that the entire being, which is largely defined by culture, the neocortical brain cannot operate without the cultural milieu in which it is situated. And so you have to understand their predicament. It's very much like the fundamentalist Christian that we encounter in America, who likewise feel very threatened by scientific materialism.
Can I ask you this? Unfortunately, we have so many hands that have gone up, but we are already over the time, which is unfortunate. We also have a book signing with Eben Alexander. But can I ask each one of you to perhaps respond to your vision of, with all of the things that you're seeing, with all of the things that you're doing in your particular fields, how do you see the future for humanity, let's say, for this earth at this point? And if you could each just tell us one thing that you would like for everybody here to take away from this. So just hand it off to each one of you, if you would.
Okay. I will. Well, I think I'm very optimistic about where this world is headed. And that is not coming from ignorance about so much of the tragedy that is forced on us on a daily basis around this world. I believe a lot of that is part of, as Ahmed has put it very, very succinctly, there are groups that feel extremely threatened by an awakening. It's an awakening that actually was initiated long ago, thousands of years ago, by various prophets, an awakening towards love, peace, harmony, towards a realization that we are truly all one and that this is a much bigger experience, this connection of oneness. And it actually, in my view, is important because it has ties that go far beyond the bounds of this earth and of this era. And I believe that awakening is coming now for a reason. And part of the kind of the symptomatology of it is a lot of the hardship and difficulties. As I said earlier, in essence, this begins to look a lot like an attempted suicide on a planetary scale. And there is much that can be learned through such extreme hardship and challenge that, as I often put it, the darkness of that valley is often matched by the love and light when one learns the lesson and ascends to the ridge. And I believe that is what we're going through now. And that's part of why we see so much tragedy, like what we saw unfold this week with the shooting down of an airliner. We cannot keep going. The status quo is not sustainable. So there's a reason for all of this to unfold the way it's unfolding now. And I think the people in this room and like-minded people around this world realize this. And it's really about oneness. And any part of that dogma in science or philosophy or religion that tries to separate us is false. It's a twisted distortion of the original message of the prophets. And it's time for us to get this right. And I believe that's why we're going through this awakening now as we are.
Eben, we need to ask you to keep talking because we'll pass a collection plate around with that. It is Sunday, after all.
Dean, would you go next, please?
Sure. I'm also optimistic. I wouldn't be doing the kind of research that I am if I wasn't optimistic. I think that part of the reason why there's a lot of complexity and even chaotic behavior on part of humans is both our failing and our strength. The failing is that it creates a lot of suffering, but the strength is that it means that we're extremely flexible. And it's been that flexibility since the beginning of Homo sapiens that we've been able to adjust to major changes in climate and creation and destruction of civilizations and so on. So it's the very flexibility that will allow us to survive into the future that is also creating a certain amount of foment, and much of that's not going to be very pleasant. The takeaway message then is that what we need to see, I think, in meetings like you're having there and the ones that we have at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and many others, is a way to attract younger people into these concepts. Because younger people are interested in these, but there's different ways of expressing it and different ways of wanting to come together. And so we're spending a fair amount of time at IONS to the Institute of Noetic Sciences to figure out how to address these kinds of topics, which are of very high concern to the younger people since they're going to live in it, in a way that is compatible to them. And so I'm very happy that we every summer we have student interns who can spend a couple of months with us, and we always have many more applicants than we can possibly take. And that says to me that, especially when we talk to these people, that they're all in their early 20s, they're fascinated with this, and they are the future. And so those are the ones that we need to talk to, not just ourselves.
Okay, great. So I will now give a balanced view, I hope. I agree with Dean completely. I agree with you also completely. So the idea is to at once work on the worldview aspects. And there, really, we have made some very good progress, especially I think quantum physics looks just so promising that it would not be an exaggeration to say that if people could get the quantum worldview, which is almost a century old now, then certainly we could expect a groundswell of activity in the stuff that you are hearing at this conference. And that could change the worldview overnight if that were the case. Of course, that won't be the case, but it's not very far-fetched to say that young people they are getting bored with information technology. This information is everything is not working anymore because the technology has shown some stopping. It cannot just go on forever. So that's all good news. The other part of the good news continues to be assemblies like this. And my experience with quantum activism is that, you know, it's amazing because 70% of our audiences are women. And what kind of women? Middle-aged, many of them are divorced and disillusioned with the usual materialist ways of living life. And they want something meaningful. And men too, in that midlife transition, who can overcome the attraction towards recapturing their youth, are waking up to the fact that no, there is some sense in older traditions which says that as you get approach this midlife, you will really have a chance of a second birth, and you can get into the unity consciousness with a protracted, well-defined series of lifestyle changes that you can make. And what happens then is becoming clear. What happens then is that we learn to love as we explore relationships, stable relationships, in or outside of marriage, I don't care, but stable relationships, committed relationships. And we find, we discover love circuits. We make love circuits in our brain. And with Rupert Sheldrake's work to guide us, we can say with some confidence that indeed, if we make these love circuits, in a few generations, they will get into the mainstream of humanity. So although I still am very pessimistic about the fact that scientific materialism is still rampant and still the most popular, and the media is hell-bent to make it even more popular, but still we have this core. I mean, there's just undeniably, there is at least 5 million of us. And I'm referring to the success of World the Bleep. Basically, 5 million people watched World the Bleep. And that's a fantastic news, because those people are dedicated people of wanting to transform, change their life for the better understanding of this unity, which is what holds the world together. So if we can make this a goal in together, understanding that assembly is very important for developing non-local consciousness, as Dean's early experiments proved to us, you know, in an assembly there really is much more of that non-local consciousness than ordinary disjointed people meditating together. So if we could just develop this kind of sangha, using the Buddhist term, and spread them worldwide, make them work together towards developing love circuits in their brain, then I think we can change entire species in just a matter of 6-7 generations. Thank you.
Thank you to our wonderful panel. Was it good or wasn't it? Thought-provoking.